This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Shifting Shadows, Stories from the World of Mercy Thompson by Patricia Briggs, performed by Lorelei King and Alexander Sendiz. Introduction. Dear reader, you hold in your hand or your ebook reader the entirety of every short story ever published, plus four, that I have written in the world of Mercy Thompson. Short stories have allowed me to explore Mercy's world from different perspectives, to tell stories that couldn't be told in the books, and to go places the books do not. We have organized the stories by the order in which they happen. There are a few that could have gone anywhere, gray, and a few that were difficult because they happened in different times, but we managed to find a place for each. I hope you enjoy the journey as much as I have. Patricia Briggs. Silver. Herein is the ill-fated romance between Ariana and Samuel, the first half of the story that continues in Silverborn. This is also an origin story of sorts, because how he met Ariana is also tied up with the story of the witch, his grandmother, who held Samuel and his father for such a long time. I have to say that if it had not been for the constant requests for this story, I, usually a teller of happier tales, would have left this one alone. As a historical note, and for those who need to know how old Samuel and Bran are, Christianity came to Wales very early, perhaps as early as the 1st or 2nd century with the Romans. When exactly the events of this novella took place, neither Samuel nor Bran could tell me. Bran just smiled like a boy without cares, so I knew it hurt him to remember, and said, "We didn't pay attention to time that way, not then." Samuel told me, "When you get just so old, those first days blur together." I am not a werewolf, but I can, after all this time, tell when Samuel is lying to me. I do know that the events in this story happen a long, long time before Moon called.
1. Samuel. 3 weeks to the day after I buried my youngest child, and several days after I buried my oldest, a young woman who would never become older. Someone knocked at my door. I rolled off my sleeping mat to my feet, but made no move to answer the knock. It was pitch dark outside, and the only reason anyone knocked at my door in the middle of the night was because someone was ill. All of my knowledge of herb lore and healing had not been able to save my wife or my children. If someone was ill, they were better off without me.
"I can hear you," said my da's voice gruffly. "Let me in."
Another day, before the death of my family, I would have been surprised. It had been a long time since I'd heard my father's voice. But my da, he'd always known when I was in trouble. That insight had outlasted my childhood. I was beyond caring about anything, expected or unexpected. Being used to doing what he asked, I opened the door and stepped back. The man standing outside entered quickly, careful not to lose the heat of the evening's fire. The hearth in the center of my home was banked and covered for the night, and I wouldn't fuel it again until the morning. With the door shut, the room was too dark to see because the window openings were also covered against the cold night air. I did not see how he did it because there was no sound of striking flint, but he lit the tallow candle. He had always kept a candle on the ledge just inside the door, where one of the rocks that formed the walls of the house stuck out. After he had gone and left the hut to me, I found it practical to leave one there as well. In that dim but useful light, he pulled down the hood of his tattered cloak, and I saw his lined face, which looked older and more weather-beaten than when I'd last seen him, a dozen or more seasons ago. His hair was threaded through with hoary gray, and his beard was an unfamiliar snow-white. He moved with a limp that he hadn't had the last time I'd seen him, but other than that, he looked good for an old man. He set down the big pack he carried on his back and the leather bag that held his pipes. He shrugged off his outerwear and hung it up beside the door where my dad had always hung such things. "The crows told me that you needed me," he said to my silence. He seldom spoke of uncanny things, my dad, and only to the family, which was down to just me, as my younger brother had died 4 years ago of a wasting sickness. But Da was better at predicting things and knowing things than the hedge witch who held sway in our village. He also had an easier time lighting fires or candles than any other person I knew. Wet wood, poor tinder, or untrimmed wick. It didn't matter to him. "I don't know how you can help," I told him, my voice harsh from lack of use. "They are all dead. My wife. My children." He looked down, and I knew that it wasn't news to him, that the crows, or whatever magic had spoken to him, had told him about their deaths. "Well then," he said, "it was time for me to come." He looked up and met my eyes, and I could see the worry in his face. "Though I thought that I ran ahead of trouble, not behind." The words should have sent a chill down my spine, but I foolishly believed that the worst thing that could happen to me already had. "How long are you staying?" I asked. He tilted his head as if he heard something that I did not. "For the winter," he told me at last, and I tried not to feel relief that I would not be alone. I tried not to feel anything but grief. My family deserved my grief, and I, who had failed to save them, did not deserve to feel relief. It was a harsh winter, as if nature herself mourned with me. My dad, he didn't get in the way of my grieving, but he did make sure I got up every morning and did the things that were needful to get through the day. He didn't push. Just watched me until I did the right thing. A man worked, and he tended those things that needed tending. I knew those lessons from my childhood. He wasn't the man people gainsaid, and that was as true of me as it was the rest of the village. People came by to greet him. Some of the attention was because he'd been respected and liked, but more was because he could be coaxed to play for them. Music wasn't uncommon in our village. Most folk sang and played a little drum or pipe. But most folk didn't sing like my da. When my mother died, no one had been surprised when he'd taken back to traveling, singing for his room and board, as he'd been doing when he first met her. People brought him a little of whatever they had to pay for his music. And between that and the medicine I traded in barter, we had enough for winter stores, even though I hadn't put things back as I usually did. I hadn't been worried about whether there was enough food to eat or enough wood to burn. I hadn't worried about myself because I'd have as soon joined my little family in their cold graves. With my da here, that root now smacked of cowardice. And if I forgot that sometimes, my da's cool gaze reminded me. It felt odd, though, not to have someone to take care of. For so long I had been the head of the family. I was not in the habit of worrying about my dad. He wasn't the kind of person who needed anyone to fuss over him. He'd survived his childhood. Not that he'd spoken of it to me beyond that it had been rough. But my ma, she'd known whatever it had been, and it had sparked fierce pride tinged with sorrow and tenderness. I knew only that he'd left his home while still a stripling boy. He had traveled and thrived in a world hostile to strangers. He was tough, and it gave him confidence that had backed down my ma's folk when they objected to her marrying a man from outside the village. He was smart, and more than that, he was wise. When he spoke on village matters, which he didn't do often, the villagers listened to him. He'd survived traveling the world after my mother's death. and he was still lit with the joy that made my home warmer than the logs on the hearth, though the chill left by the death of my little ones and their ma was deep. My Da, he could survive anything, and his example forced me to do the same, even when I didn't want to. 2. Samuel. On the shortest night of the year, when the full moon hung in the sky, my grandmother came to us. I'd returned to my duties as village healer, so I didn't even think of not answering a knock in the dead of night. Da had gotten used to the middle-of-the-night summonses that were the lot of a healer. He didn't stir, though I was certain he was awake. I opened the door to a stranger. She was a wild-looking young woman, with hair that flowed in unkempt, tangled tresses all the way to the back of her knees. Her face was uncanny, and so beautiful that I didn't pay much heed to the beast that crouched beside her, huge though he was.
"The sun,"
she said to me.
"The magic flows strongly in you,"
her voice echoed in my head. "No," said my Da, who had exploded to his feet the moment I opened the door. He stepped between us. "You will not have him."
"You shouldn't have run away,"
she told him.
"But I forgive you, because you brought the gift with you."
"I will never willingly serve you, mother," my Da said, in a voice I'd never heard from him before. "I told you we are done."
"You speak as though I would give you a choice,"
she said. She glanced down, and the beast I had taken for a dog lunged at my Da. I grabbed the cudgel I kept beside the door, but the beast was faster than I was. It had time to bury its fangs in my Da's gut and jerk him between us. The only reason I didn't brain Da was because I dropped the cudgel mid-swing. And after that, there was no chance to fight. She turned us into monsters. Werewolves. Though I didn't hear that term for many years. She bound us to her service with witchcraft and more cruelly, through her ability to break into our minds. In this she had more trouble with Da than with the rest of her wolves. Though she looked like a young woman to all of my senses, I think she was centuries old when she came knocking on my door. The first transformation from human to werewolf is harsh under the best of circumstances. I now know that most people attacked brutally enough to be changed die. The witch had some way to interfere, to hold her victims to life until they became the beasts she desired. Even so, I would have died if my Da had not anchored me. I heard his voice in my head, cool and demanding, and I had to obey him. Had to live. That he was able to do this while undergoing a like fate to mine is a fair insight into the man my Da is. That I lived was something that took me a very long time to forgive him for. I do not know, nor do I wish to, how long I lived as a werewolf serving my grandmother. It could have been a decade or centuries, though I think it was closer to the latter than the former. It was long enough that I had time to forget my given name. I deliberately left it behind because I was no longer that person. But I had not thought to lose it altogether. My name was not the only memory I lost. I no longer remembered my first wife's face or the faces of my children, though sometimes in dreams, even all these centuries later, I hear the cry of "Taid! Taid!" as a child calls for his father. The voice, I believe, is that of my firstborn son. In the dream, he is lost, and I cannot find him no matter where I look. My Da likes to say that sometimes forgetfulness is a gift. Perhaps, had I remembered them clearly, remembered what I'd once had, I would not have survived my time serving the witch. I learned to live in the moment, and the wolf who shared my body and soul made it easy. A beast feels no remorse for the past nor hope for the future. 3. Ariana. Once upon a time, there was a fair maiden of the fairy courts who rode away from a hunting party chasing something she could glimpse just ahead of her. Eventually, she came to a glade where a strange and handsome man awaited her with food and drink. She ate the food and drank his wine, and stayed with the Lord of the Forest even when the rest of her people found her, sending them back to the court without her. Time passed, and she gave birth to a girl child who grew up as talented as she was wise. In a human tale, this couple would have had a happily ever after ending. But the Fae are not human, and they live a very, very long time. Happily ever after is seldom long enough for them, and that was true for these two lovers. But for a time, they were as happy as any. They called their daughter Ariana, which means silver, as she early on had an affinity for that metal. As she grew up, it became apparent that her power harked back to the height of Fae glory. By the time she reached adulthood, her power outshone even the Forest Lord's, and he was centuries old and steeped with the magic of the forest. It is true that the High Court Fae were notoriously fickle. It is also true that a Forest Lord has two aspects. The first is civilized and beautiful as any of the Tuatha De Dunham. The second is wild as the forest he rules. The She Lady eventually grew bored, or perhaps her distaste for her lover's wilder half became too strong. Whatever the reason, she left her grown daughter and her lover without a farewell or notice, to return to the court. The Forest Lord mourned his lover only briefly, for his kind, too, are as light in their affections as they are terrible in their hatreds. For a while after she left, he still loved his daughter and took joy in her. But when her power eclipsed his own, he grew jealous and spiteful. When the other Fae took notice of her gifts and came to her with gold and jewels to entice her to share her magic, his jealousy outgrew his love and made it as nothing. 4. Samuel. The pack customarily bedded down in the woods behind the witch's cottage. It was mountainous there, but not particularly cold, though winter still held snow and autumn a fine frost. Our coats were thick, and the interior of the cottage was smoky, too warm, and reeked unpleasantly of rotting things, both physical and spiritual. I don't know about my Da or the others, but I was happy to be out of the witch's way as much as possible. She kept us hidden from those who sought her services, both as unseen protection, because she dealt with powerful and dread beings, and as a precaution, because she only mostly controlled us. My Da she never let too near her unless she had some of the other, more obedient wolves nearby. My father curled up by himself, raised his head as I came back from hunting. He stood and gave me a look before turning and trotting off into the woods where the leaves were ruddy and gold. I hesitated, but even then, the obedience was a part of our relationship. Instead of settling down to sleep until morning as I had planned, I stretched twice, then ran in his trail until I caught up. Though I didn't look behind me, I knew that the others followed, as they always did. At first, I thought the other wolves followed us to spy for the witch, but time had proven that wrong. There were 6 of us werewolves, 7 really, though we all knew that Ada was dying. He had trouble stumbling down the trail into the hollow, and I would have to help him up it when we returned. I had the impression that my father had known some of the wolves from his childhood, but he never confirmed or denied it. He never spoke to them or of them when we were in human form, and they never left their wolf shape. Da had found a small sheltered hollow in the lee of a downed oak shortly after the witch had brought us here. It served to keep us hidden and offered some protection from the weather for our naked bodies. Even though my human skin didn't get cold as it had before the wolf entered my soul, skin was not as good as fur. It wasn't winter yet, but the leaves had begun to change to autumn's colors, and there was a bite to the air. Da began his change as soon as we were in the oak's protection, but instead of following his example as I usually did, I hesitated. Life was easier when I let the wolf rule the man. The wolf killed and killed, and it did not turn his stomach or make him mourn for the creature he used to be. Da saw that I was hesitating and growled at me, a demand the wolf wouldn't disobey even if I wanted to. It hurt. I don't know how my father even figured out that we could change back to human. I didn't remember doing it the first time. If I thought about it too long, there were a frightening number of things I couldn't remember very well. It had taken me a while before I realized that. When my grandmother chose to use my pain to feed her magic, she sometimes stole more than just blood or flesh. Skin-absorbing fur felt like bee stings. The crack of bone was no less painful than a real break. The witch didn't want her wolves to turn human. But I didn't understand that then. Didn't understand how her magic fought the change to human. I just knew that it hurt. She must have known we changed into our human skins. I do not know why she didn't interrupt. Perhaps she was more afraid of my father than she let on.
Why are we still doing this?
I asked Dad while I was still on hands and knees and sweating from the required effort.
What good does it do except to remind us of what we once were?
He frowned at me. I made a promise to your mother, boy. When I told her what my blood was, I promised I would never allow you to stay in my mother's hands. If you lose your humanity to the wolf, then my mother has won. I stood up, waited until I was steady on my feet, then raised my hands and turned around slowly so he could see all of me, naked and filthy. There's more to being human than the resemblance I bear to Amanda. I have left humanity so far behind. No, he growled. He jerked his chin toward the other wolves. Not like they have. You know right from wrong, good from evil. It would be easier if I could forget. I knew what he would say even before he said it. He was not fond of self-pity, my da. Easier doesn't mean better. He didn't say anything more. We never talked much at times like these, when he required me to take on human form. What was there to say? Neither of us wanted to talk of people long dead, nor of the day just past, or the one to come. He believed that his mother would grow complacent and make a mistake. I had believed him long past foolish hope, but years and decades and then tens of decades had worn my faith away as a river wears away stone. But I loved my dad, and I would not hurt him more with my disbelief. Let him believe in a better end than I saw. The end would come, whatever we believed, and he found comfort in that future he saw for us. I did not tell him that even if we broke free, we would still be the monsters she had made us. My da, he was a smart man. He knew that as well as I did. The other wolves waited, their eyes trained on my da. But it was the soft whine from Ada that my da acquiesced to. He sat down on the ground, threw back his head, and sang. I settled with my back to the oak and listened. His voice had lost the old man's quaver I'd noticed in that last winter we'd spent together as humans, just as both of us had lost the silver hair and the aging skin. Made young again by my grandmother's magic or the bite of the wolf, I had no reason to ask or care. My father had no instrument but that with which he was born, but that was fine indeed. When he sang, the others gathered around closely, but he only looked at the dying wolf, who laid his muzzle on my father's naked thigh and listened as his breath wheezed in and out. The music and the touch of my Da's hand seemed to comfort him. Witches use the suffering of others for their power, and a werewolf could suffer a great deal before he died. The first sign that Ada was dying was when his ears never grew back quite right. Healthy, we could regrow bits and pieces we lost. Instead of leaving him be, letting him get stronger as she'd done a time or two to others, she'd taken his left front paw when she needed to harvest his pain for her power. We all did what we could for him. When he died, she would spend time with all of us again, until someone started to weaken. Then she would single him out and kill him by inches. There had been two other wolves who had died that slow death, but my father had not sung to them.
Had not sung at all in all the years of our captivity, until this wolf had appealed to him without words.
I didn't know why this wolf was different, and I would not ask him. After a while, I joined in Da's song. Our voices worked well together, as they always had. Music hurt more than the shift to human had, because music recalled better days. Days when I had loved and was loved in return. Days when the turning of seasons had meaning. But it hurt worse not to sing. Moreover, when it brought my father some bits of joy, even in the darkest day, how could I not sing? When change came, it snuck up on me. I did not recognize it for what it was when it began. Autumn ruled still, but the nights were longer, and I could catch the acrid smell of snow in the air. Not today or the next day, but sometime in the next week there would be a storm. I was not far from the cottage when I spied one of the fair folk coming to call on the witch. That was unusual because the fair folk, the Talwith Teg, had their own powers and usually would have no truck with witchcraft. He was, as they all were, beautiful. Tall, with eyes as deep blue as the winter sea under dark skies. His skin was silvery with cracks of darkness, like the bark of the Bedouin. Before my grandmother turned me into this beast, I had never seen a fae, though I'd heard stories about them. They were still a rare enough sight to attract my interest. After a brief hesitation, I abandoned the rabbit's trail I'd been following to ghost behind the fae instead. Tromping through the remains of the autumn leaves in the witch's woods with no weapon in his hand, and looking neither left nor right, this one looked as though he would be easy prey. I knew better. The fae were tough, vicious, and deadly, especially the ones that strode through the forest as though they owned it. The lesser fae mostly stayed to the shadows and kept out of the way of things with big, sharp teeth. This one was not one of the Tuatha De Danann, the High Court Lords who, above all else, my grandmother feared. So I was under no obligation of her magical chains to report his intrusion. But he was a power. I could feel the forest's attention upon him. I moved closer to let my nose get a better read on this one. His track smelled of bitterness and jealousy, small sniveling emotions, though his body language and the forest alertness spoke of his power. I stayed out of his sight as he walked directly to the clearing where the witch made her home. He rapped sharply on the door, and my grandmother opened it. She was dressed in a thin shift that left nothing to the imagination, and her thick sandy hair glimmered in the sun like honey, pouring over her shoulders and hips. She raised her eyebrows when she got a good look, but she stepped back from the entry and let him in without protest. Curiosity had me skulking to the side of the building and pressing my ear to the wall. She didn't know we could hear what went on in the cottage, but we weren't telling her.
"I'm surprised," my grandmother said coyly, "to see one of your ilk here calling on such as me."
She was pretty, my grandmother, but not as beautiful as the fair folk, nor was she stupid. If she sounded coy, it was to make the fae believe her less than she was.
Powerful things in his world didn't bow and scrape or creep. They attacked from the front with plenty of warning.
"I'm the lord of this forest," he told her,
She believed the forest was hers. Indeed, the locals called it the Witch's Woods.
I know,
she said without hesitation, and her disdain was sly and hidden.
The birds whisper it to me, and the wind sings with your power. But two nights ago, a pair of fairy sight hounds came to me. They wore coats of white and rust, and in that way I knew them for fear hounds, the bane hounds of old. So fearsome they were, as to stop the very heart in my chest. They came to my dreams and told me that they were gone away, that you could no more hold them obedient. They broke free of your leash. Such creatures do not make good slaves, so they told me.
Her voice was innocent and light, but I could feel the malice in her intent.
Take care, witch, he said.
They left a promise and a warning for you,
she said, her voice softening.
They said that the power you threw away to pad your vanity will not return to you because the followers of the sacrificed god have reached our shores. Already Underhill writhes under their cold iron and colder prayers. In a few centuries they will bind the magic in this land, and all the Fae will be powerless before them.
I heard a noise, the sound of flat hand meeting cheek, and smirked inwardly because I cared not a smidgen for either of them. He had hit her, and he would pay dearly for it.
You overstep yourself, witch, he snarled. You are here on my sufferance. Your presence debases my forest with foulness, and you draw the mortals who seek you through my lands.
There was a little silence. I wondered if we would feast on a forest lord tonight. I licked my lips. Hunting had been lean within the area around the cottage where we could roam without leave from the witch, and she had not been inclined to allow us to forage farther afield.
I meant no disrespect, sir,
she said in an obsequious voice that managed to convey fear and respect. Oh yes, I thought, we would dine on this one.
I only relay information I have been given. I thought you came because you needed something from me. Did you come to drive me away?
I could hear the rustle of fabric as he paced.
I need to call my hounds again, the Fey Lord said, his voice low and vicious. I have a task to set them to. You will make it possible, or you will not need to worry about where you might live.
Yes, yes, of course. I understand, sir.
Her voice was sweet and honey-soft.
Is your need life and death, or simply desire?
There was a long pause.
I cannot help you if you do not tell me, she pled. My magic responds to need. I must know what you want and how much you want it.
I wondered why the Fae could not hear the lie as clearly as I could. But he did not know her, and she lied very well. The Fae lied not at all, and so were not always good at seeing untruths when they were uttered.
Yes, his answer to her was reluctant. Life and death. My word has been given to someone who will destroy me if I cannot keep it.
Then I can do something,
said my grandmother briskly, as if a servile tone had never touched her voice.
I can give you power to call hounds, but, as I am sure you know, my power works on sacrifice. For this, the cost will be dear.
Not just to any hounds, he said sharply, thinking he saw her trap.
The Fae didn't lie, but deception was an art form to them.
The magical beasts.
I didn't need to see her smile to feel her satisfaction as he came to her trap without seeing it at all. He was prey, no matter how powerful he was. He was not clever enough to escape her.
and she would forgive neither the slap nor the threat.
Magical beasts in dog-like form, she clarified.
He hadn't listened to her. She'd told him that he wouldn't be able to call the Fey dogs again. But she was not Fey. She could lie all the time, and she did so when it suited her. But I could tell that she had not lied about that. Magical beasts in dog-like form. That would be us. She meant to let him call wolves when he expected his own hounds. Maybe, maybe if he had controlled the Fey Bane hounds, who were fearsome beasts, he could control us. For a while. Yes, the Forest Lord said, not questioning her phrasing. After all, she was only responding to his request to clarify. He never thought to ask her what other magical dog-like beasts there were nearby. I didn't know if he was truly stupid, or if he did not recognize the threat she represented. The Fey were proud, worse back in those days, when they ruled and the humans feared. They did not easily take notice of threats that were not Fey in origin.
I can do that, she said slowly, as if after careful consideration. You will pay me a pound of silver.
Fine, he said easily, though it was more than she'd normally have seen in 10 years of work.
That is the cost you owe me, she told him. But the magic will cost your hand. All witchcraft magic has a price, and I cannot bear that for you. You can decide if it is the left or right.
Silence enveloped the hut, and I left before that changed. If she realized I was there, she would make me do it, just because she knew it would hurt me. There was the faint possibility that she might do it herself. She enjoyed causing pain. But bones are hard to sever, and that one's wrath would focus on the one who took his hand. Probably it would be Daffid, who led our pack. Let Daffid chew the Fey's hand off. He would enjoy it more than I. Daffid was not the name the leader of our wolf pack was born with, any more than my father was Selif or I was Soil. David, Solomon, and Samuel. She changed our names each time she moved, which she did when the mood took her. Sometimes we moved every month for a year. Sometimes we stayed in a place as we had here for decades. This time in this place, it pleased my grandmother to use names found in the stories of the followers of the sacrificed god. I did not know why, and did not care. I had forgotten my own name. Soil or Samuel would do. Whatever name she called him by, though, my da, he was Bran. And she could not take that away from me.
5. Ariana. The little hobgoblin did her best to follow orders no matter how her heart hurt. Haida cleaned the shivering, scared thing that used to be her lady, paying no attention to the way it flinched or gibbered or cried, just as she had been instructed. She also ignored the way the magic swirled around it, volatile and miserable and deadly. Haida covered the open wounds and salves that she had made herself this morning from plants she had gathered outside. Neither she nor her lady trusted anything in their home. It was unstable, reflecting the madness of its lord. In an older time, this would not have been dangerous. Underhill was vast and had been robust, healing itself of spiritual wounds. But Underhill was losing its connection to the mundane world and becoming capricious. For those who dwelt in the Forest Lord's home in Underhill, the wise ate and drank nothing that had been in the cupboards overnight, nor anything that had dwelt in the home as long as a day. When the hobgoblin had done what she could for the wounds with her salves, she covered the shivering form with clothing and jewels strung on silver chains, then began the process of helping the creature to a stool where it could sit and eat.
"Don't think of me as a person when I'm like that," her lady had told her. "I know I look like myself, but it is not me. It is a beast, a dangerous beast." Be cautious and careful. You alone can help me defeat him.
The lady was clever, much more clever than Haida, so she followed her rules to the letter. Food.
Eat,
the hobgoblin urged the thing that used to be her lady. Would be again. It had worked before. It had to work this time, too.
It's only a bit of bread and honeycomb. It will do you good.
Haida took a bite, to show the thing both that it was edible and that if it didn't eat soon, Haida might eat all the food. Whatever logic it used, the scarred and broken thing ate as soon as Haida swallowed. As it ate, the outwardly broken parts of it, bones and sinew, knit together and smoothed out into a more pleasing form, until the beast started to look more like Haida's lady again, outwardly at least. Haida's lady, Ariana, was strong with magic from both sides of her bloodline. The magic allowed her to heal from things that would have killed a hobgoblin. Her father was a forest lord, an independent but powerful fae, her mother one of the high ladies of the highest courts, and would that she were here. But it had been years since she left, and not a word of reply to any message or plea sent by the hobgoblin, who had once served her faithfully, and now served her daughter. Even as Haida thought about her grievance with her lady's mother, the building around them groaned and shifted, disturbed by her fretting or, more likely, by the beast's turmoil. So much power in the hands of the angry and traumatized beast that wore Ariana's body was not a happy thing, and Haida's anger was making their home worse. She could do something about both matters, and hopefully their place in Underhill would settle a little. Haida focused her thoughts on her task and brought another tray of food to the table. Food stolen this morning from three different villages to keep humans from taking too much notice. The food served the dual purpose of distracting the beast from whatever had the floor uneasy under her feet, and further strengthening her lady. The beast ate everything Haida could provide, then looked up at her with eyes that were solid black. In all other aspects, the beast looked like her lady now, though bruised and battered, but the eyes were always deep, fathomless, black.
There is one more necessary thing,
it told her, in a voice made hoarse by screaming and slow from terror and exhaustion. That it spoke meant that her lady was near.
Yes,
Haida agreed, and prepared to pull a fog over the beast's recent memories. Like most of the lesser fae, Haida had a few things she did very well, but hers was a milder magic, not easily directed in small spells or bindings. Fogging the beast's memory was difficult for her, and if it fought her, she would not be able to do it at all. But she didn't need to keep the memories at bay for long, just for long enough. Haida touched the beast's forehead, and the beast grabbed Haida's hand and growled.
Soil. Samuel. Samuel White Wolf,
the beast said. Haida waited. The beast's magic was thick, and it flowed by the hobgoblin like a winter wind, biting and uncomfortable.
Samuel,
the beast murmured more gently, sounding too much like her lady. It released Haida and rubbed at its eyes as it whispered,
They come. The wolves. Death comes with them. Remember.
The beast had powers that her lady did not. Powers more akin to Haida's own, though much more powerful. The hobgoblin had no doubt that the words meant something. It would probably be bad because nothing good could come out of the ugliness that was the beast. So her lady had told Haida, and so Haida believed. When the beast did not seem inclined to say anything more, the hobgoblin touched the creature gently and continued with the task the talk of wolves had interrupted. When she had the proper shape of the magic within her, she settled her magic on the beast. She petted its forehead and said,
Forget. Let the mists hide the worst and leave only the best.
Her magic snuck in and clothed the beast's memories in kindness, a thing possible only because the beast allowed it. The change was immediate. The terrible beast faded. Instead of the horrible wounded thing, her lady blinked at Haida, the blackness shrinking down until it was pupil only, and her eyes were wide and jewel green. Open wounds were absorbed by deep brown skin, scars hidden by glamour until she looked no different than she ever had.
"Hobgoblin,"
she said, sounding a little confused but not distressed. Her lady looked around the kitchen, Haida's domain. It was neat and tidy as always, if not so grand as the rest of the house. The hobgoblin felt the moss-covered walls of the kitchen, which had pulled back in distress at the beast's presence, ease back into place. But the stillness had a waiting feeling rather than that of a home at peace, and she worried.
"Yes, my lady,"
said the hobgoblin sadly, because the confusion in her lady's face was being replaced by worse things, as the magic Haida had worked, was dispelled, and memory resettled properly. Her lady only needed to forget that breath of time, so that she would have courage to take back her power and body from the beast. Her father, the forest lord, was dual-natured. He had the form of the Shi and another of a forest fae. Ariana's beast was born of that heritage, but had her father not brutalized her with pain and the terror of the hounds he commanded, it would never have materialized. The beast, a creature of the forest, unlike Ariana, could not disobey a direct order from the forest lord. What had started out as a punishment had borne useful fruit for Ariana's father. Haida's lady sucked in a breath and looked at her hands, moving the fingers gently, then clenching them into fists.
"I don't remember everything the beast did this time,"
she said, her voice tight.
"Did it do what he wanted us to do?"
Haida shook her head.
"I don't know, mistress. Your magic is beyond me. You'll have to look at what it created yourself."
The little hobgoblin, green-gray and covered with wiry hair from head to feet, was closer to the heart of magic than the Telwith Teg, the greater fae like Ariana. Haida was like a shepherd who cared for the flocks, and Ariana a weaver who worked tapestries with their yarn. One was not inherently more skilled or powerful than the other, but differently able. Other fae did not see it as Ariana did, including Haida. To them, lesser fae were weak, but for her father, their home shivered and groaned, while only Haida could bring it comfort. If it had not been for Haida, Ariana knew she would have long ago been lost to the beast. Ariana shed the last of the hobgoblin's veil of shadows, ready to face the results of her father's bidding and the beast's obedience. The first few times she'd been able to remember what she'd done after her father reduced her to that other aspect. But eventually, her memories had not been so clear. This time, like the time before, she could remember nothing after she'd broken under the wave of terror that was the Banehound's magic. Her father would succeed in destroying her. All she could hope for was to ensure that he got no gain by it. She was so afraid that she would fail even in that. She stood up carefully, but although she was dizzy and weak, the pain of her injuries was fading quickly.
"How long this time?"
she asked Haida as Ariana walked out of the kitchen and down the hall with the poise her mother had drilled into her before she left. The advantage of moving with grace was that it kept her centered, so she didn't fall on her face. Every time her bare feet touched the floor, she drew magic from the earth to strengthen herself, just as the food she'd eaten had strengthened her.
4 days,
Haida told her.
"He left as soon as the dogs finished."
That was unusual. He liked to supervise her work, though what she did was so far outside of his forest-bound magic that he could not follow it. There was something she should remember about the dogs. The color of old blood and snow, with fangs that tore. The hounds delivered pain and terror to freeze her forever. That was the gift of the white and red hounds of the forest lord, terror that stopped the breath and heart.
My lady?
Not that. She couldn't remember that, or she wouldn't stay in control. If she were reduced to her other aspect, the one who could only follow the orders of the power that gave a forest lord dominion over the beasts in his forest, all would be lost. There was nothing left now of the father who had loved her. The one who had taken her on long walks in the woods and taught her to speak to the deep-voiced oaks and the quivering willow. No more than there was anything left of the daughter who had loved him and believed that he could do no wrong. He told her that he had a commission for which he'd been well paid in favors and power. The power was what he craved, almost as much as he wanted to see her reduced to something that could only obey him, something he had no reason to be jealous of. She was to make a weapon that could be used to siphon the magic from any fae, she, hobgoblin, and anything in between. Her father couldn't or wouldn't see beyond his immediate goals, to what such an artifact meant. He was not the only fae who had lost power beneath the growing tide of iron, nor was he the most corrupt. The Tuatha De Danann, who commissioned the work, was powerful, but there were others yet stronger. By the artifact's very existence, it would cause a war that would not end until there was no one left who desired it. Ultimately, it would bring an end to the fae, and everything they would destroy in their wake. Her father, blinded by need, was determined to force her to use her magic to make the artifact. She was more determined that she would not. Ariana turned into her workroom and looked at the fist-sized lump of silver that lay on the table. As soon as she picked it up, she understood that she had failed.
"The main spell is set,"
she told Haida, her voice raw. She held the destruction of the world in her hand.
"We are undone." "Can you use it to destroy him?"
asked the hobgoblin, ever practical.
"When the sight of him turns my knees to water?"
Ariana said bitterly.
"He has changed me. Made me a frightened and powerless creature who is as obedient to his command as any of his hounds ever were. I cannot move against him in his presence."
Once she'd been strong-willed and powerful, but now she was nothing. A shadow of what she had been. Broken to her father's will, except in these stolen moments. But there was something about her father's hounds, something she should remember.
"Then we are undone,"
said Haida practically, licking delicately at her hand, then smoothing it over the hair on her cheeks.
"If you have finished what he wanted, we should leave. He will follow. He cannot be what he is and not give chase. But he will play with his new toy first. It would give us a chance to lose ourselves in the world. I can keep us hidden from his hounds for many days. My magic is not powerful, but it is subtle."
Courageous hobgoblin. Haida always examined a problem and found the best path from where she found herself to somewhere she might survive. Ariana drew upon her example and examined what had already been done and sealed within the silver. Until this time of awakening, when her father was gone, she'd been able to destroy the work she'd done before he noticed. Once a spell was sealed into the silver, she could not unwork it, any more than anyone else could. She held her hand near and watched as the silver called her magic.
"As I said," she told Haida slowly, "this will eat the magic of any fae."
She paused, examining the flow of the magic in the silver because there was something unexpected that she had to work out.
"Maybe I can squeeze the flow until it is only a bare trickle. If it can only pull a little, how much harm can it do?"
The hobgoblin sank down on her haunches and smiled, revealing sharp green teeth.
I told you that you would outsmart him. When all he has to do to keep me stupefied with terror, obedient to his command, is call on his hounds?"
Ariana asked.
"You are overly optimistic. as long as he has the hounds.
And for an instant she knew why he'd left, knew that it was important, but she couldn't get past the thoughts of his hounds, and the reason for his departure trickled out of her grasp like water. Survival meant that she pay attention to the embryonic artifact in her hands, and not pull the beast inside her back to the forefront by fretting about the hounds. She turned to Haida.
Even if I slow the draw to little more than nothing, eventually it will amass power. I can make it take years, centuries maybe, but eventually it will hold enough to be valuable.
What it holds, someone can take,
the hobgoblin agreed.
Can you stop that?
No.
She was powerful, but not as powerful as some. To lay such locks on the artifact that no one could break it open was beyond her, and it would be unwise, even if she could. If it did nothing but sit in the cottage and steal magic from the fae that passed near it, eventually it would eat all magic and concentrate it in the lump of silver that fit into her hand. She didn't know how much the metal could hold, but an explosive release when the silver could hold nothing more would be destructive on a scale she could almost not comprehend. Not as horrible as what would happen if it was able to hold all of the magic indefinitely. Without magic, all life would cease.
But I can make it so the magic it collects dissipates back to the heart of magic.
The heart of magic was the center of the world. Magic held in the heart did not come readily to anyone's hand, but caused the wind to blow and the rain to fall. Ariana smiled fiercely at her little friend.
And thus fulfilling the Geas and thwarting my father.
She considered how to do that.
I need you for this, Haida. And it would probably not be easy.
Haida bowed low.
It is my joy to aid you in any manner I might. But himself will be back soon. It is unlike him to be absent for long. Is there time? Yes,
said the beast that now dwelled within Ariana.
The hounds have fled, and he seeks the means to recall them.
Ariana closed her eyes and took in a shaky breath, waiting for the beast to subside. That was what she had needed to remember. His hounds were gone. She should have felt relief, but could not shake the feeling that her father was more dangerous than ever. Could not quiet her fear of him, and that fear made the beast stir again. She could not afford to let her beast take control, not with such delicate magic to embroider. She collected herself and looked at the hobgoblin, who was watching her warily.
Haida, we can do this,
she said with more confidence than she actually felt.
The hounds have been chafing under his leash, and they have left him. That's where he has gone, to reclaim the hounds. We might have enough time to do this thing.
Using Haida's sense for the wild magic that lingered in the smallest thing and was closest to the heart of magic, Ariana worked until the hobgoblin made her stop and eat.
Then she worked some more, the constant drain from the emerging artifact only a slight handicap.
The very slowness of its working was evidence that her other self was fully engaged in the attempt to mitigate the harm the artifact could cause, something she had not known for certain. The beast had seen the way to render this artifact mostly innocuous, just as Ariana had, and had shown itself to be an ally of sorts. A fae of average power would have to keep the artifact the beast had crafted for weeks before it had an appreciable effect on his magic. So much the beast had managed. She lost track of time, so tired she did not realize that it meant the beast had come to help. When she came to herself, she held a silver bird in her hand, and just enough magic in her body to tell that it was an artifact, sealed and done. But she could not tell if she had accomplished her purpose or not. She cupped a little